May all beings possess happiness and the inner causes of happiness. May all beings be free from sorrow and the inner causes of sorrow. May all beings remain undivided from the sacred joy which is free from sorrow. May all beings come to rest in the great equanimity beyond attachment or aversion to friends, enemies, or strangers. So begin by settling the body, just allowing yourself to find a comfortable, easy posture. And let's use the breath to relax. So just take a few slow, deep breaths. And as you do, notice that the inhalation is an active process involving the contraction of muscles around the chest, the diaphragm, the shoulders. But the exhalation is a simple relaxation and letting go. So we breathe in and let go. Breathe in and let go. Breathe in and just let go. And as you do that, you will likely notice a tendency, an automatic tendency for the muscles around the chest and shoulders to release and relax. And for that sense of relaxation to spread by itself through the body, up into the neck and the jaw, out into the arms, down into the abdomen, and the pelvis, and the legs. And already you've discovered one of the secrets of relaxation. That relaxation isn't something we do, it's merely something we allow. With this relaxed body and corresponding tendency for the mind to relax, allow yourself to direct your gaze probably slightly upwards in an unfocused, relaxed way. and simply be present. Aware of the experience in this moment. And allowing things to be exactly as they are. Relaxing with awareness. Relax, let the mind be, and simply be aware. And notice that that awareness is like a 360 degree sphere. Encompassing everything. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. But everything arises within it. And if you find you've been lost in a dream, simply relax with awareness. And the dream subsides of itself. If there's agitation, difficult emotions, recurrent thoughts, simply relax with awareness. Whatever experiences arise, simply allow them to be. And if anything seems problematic, there's no need in Dzogchen to wrestle with it, try to change it. Simply relax with awareness. So Lama Surya asked if I would speak on the topic of optimizing one's retreat, looking at what we can do to have the best possible retreat for ourselves. And I was a little surprised, actually more than a little surprised, because he asked that I regularly do this at the public retreats, but has never wanted one for the advanced retreat. For whatever reason, decided we should have this talk, but raised an interesting challenge. Would you up-level it, please? Because we have everyone from people who have been to only one retreat before to very long-term and experienced Dharma practitioners. So that was an interesting challenge. So I will just lay out some principles. And given that we have such a range of experience in the room, I suspect that some of the more specific ways of enhancing retreat may come out of our subsequent discussion. So, but anyway, let's So let's just explore some of the general principles, and then we can play with some of the nuances, and I'll try to point to specifically to some of the ways in which we can optimize any retreat and some of the ways which are specific to Dzogchen. Okay, so first off, is simply the recognition that retreat is an extraordinary gift, a very, very rare and wonderful opportunity, and maybe one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves and the world. And throughout history, periods of retreat have been part of the lives of the great spiritual sages across the world, the religious founders, the Buddha himself, of course, Muhammad, Jesus. And I find very interesting that Arnold Toynbee, in his survey of world history, found the one characteristic that he felt was common to all those people who had contributed most to human well-being was that they'd gone through what he called the cycle of withdrawal and return. That is, at some stage in their life, they had realized the hollowness and superficiality of most daily life and had withdrawn from society for a period of time in order to find a secluded place in which they could turn attention inward and plumb the depths of their own being. And after quite a sustained period of time of that inner exploration, they had reached some kind of recognition, illumination, enlightenment, liberation, understanding, wisdom. And then, with that realization, also arose a recognition of the extraordinary suffering in the world and the pull to return. So this is then is the cycle withdrawal and return. It's what in Zen is symbolized in the 10th ox herding picture, where if you know those ox herding pictures, there's a picture of a sage who's kind of a looks like a kind of hobo, and the sage is described as entering the world with help bestowing hands. So. And in Christianity, there's a nice sequence that of phases of spiritual life which has been recognized as first purification, second, or purgation as it's called in that tradition, second illumination, some sort of insight understanding, finally union, recognition or dissolving of the separate self sense into the greater self. And then finally, the phase of the return to the world in the phase of what's called the fruitfulness of the soul, where the soul comes into the world and the fruits of that realization are shared with everyone. So a retreat is an extraordinarily rare opportunity. There's the possibility of this kind of illumination. There's also the possibility of cultivating some of the most wonderful qualities of heart and mind. In most practices, this is a deliberate cultivation. It's a working with the mind to specifically develop qualities such as love and compassion. But in Dzogchen, while we do those as ancillary practices, the emphasis of the practice that Lama Surya has been focusing on is this Kuntasampo practice, as he's been calling it. In Dzogchen, there's the recognition that to the extent we touch our true nature, to the extent we recognize and realize Rigpa or pure presence, to that extent, these beneficent qualities flower of themselves. Not by effort, not even by intention, but simply because they are the spontaneous natural expression of awareness. So there's a chance to cultivate remarkable and wonderful qualities. Of course, there's also the chance to recognize our true nature, to realize who we really are, to discover the secret of life. And I mean that there really is a secret of life. And it's amazing how many people search so endlessly, but really the secret of life is you. All that we're looking for is within. It's the recurrent theme of all the sages of the lineage portrayed in the tankas around us and in each tradition. And so amazing that the fundamental and most valuable secret of life is within, and yet 99.9% of us spend our lives searching without. It's the recognition of our true nature. It's the recognition of, in our practice, Rigpa. Or as one saying has it, look within, you are the Buddha. Or in Hinduism, Atman, that is individual consciousness, and Brahman, universal consciousness, are one. Or the words of Jesus, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Or Confucianism, those who know their own nature know heaven. Or Muhammad, those who know themselves know their Lord. Every tradition, all these sages, echoing the same recognition of who and what we are. So this week is an extraordinary opportunity to to recognize who we are and allow the flowering of the qualities that we actually are. So the question then is how to make the most of it, and what is the advice that is available to us. I want to make seven families of suggestions, or seven kinds of suggestions. And I want to preface them by saying that these are primarily ancillary practices. Some of them are inherent parts of our Dzogchen practice. So the ancillary ones, of course, are not the focus, the primary focus of our work here, but they're very beneficial in facilitating our primary Trekchid practice, Kuntizampo practice. So the first suggestion that sages give us is to take some time for conscious reflection. Now, usually in our meditation practice, we are not working with thought, but rather simply allowing thoughts to rise and be. But in reflection, we use thought consciously, carefully, and intentionally to cultivate desired qualities such as insight, motivation, or emotions. So what might we want to reflect on? Perhaps as we first sit down in the period just before we begin our sky gazing practice, for example. Well, the kinds of things we might want to reflect on are the benefits of the retreat, how valuable this time is to us, the brevity of this time, this short week, and how our practice may be a wonderful contribution to the world. So the benefits of the retreat and this kind of intensive practice are many, and we've talked about some of them. The cultivation of beneficial qualities, the recognition of our true nature, the exploration and investigation of some of the most central questions of life. Questions of meaning, purpose, and values. Questions of what really matters? What do I want my life to be about? How can I cultivate? How can I best cultivate desirable qualities of heart and mind? For example, how can I best learn to love, to serve, to heal, to be kind, to be sensitive? These are our sacred questions. And a retreat is a time which gives us actually a chance to recognize what our sacred questions are and to investigate them as deeply as we can. And, well, each of us is particularly drawn to specific sacred questions. For some who are particularly drawn to love, it's, you know, how can I love as fully as possible? For those of us drawn to awareness, it's how can I clarify awareness? How can I rest in Rigpa? And whether we recognize it or not, our lives revolve around our sacred question. And the depth and fullness and satisfaction of our lives is to a significant extent a function of the degree to which we explore our sacred questions as fully as possible. These are our callings. Or rather, our questions point us to our calling. And a sacred question reflects our sacred value. Each of us was particularly drawn to specific values, ideals, qualities of heart and mind that pull us, that are perhaps part of our particular personality, or as Indian says, svabhava, our unique being. So our sacred question reflects our sacred value, and so that sacred value we can find by looking at what quality or value most draws and inspires. Is it love? Is it contribution? Is it service? And how deeply we recognize and cultivate our sacred value determines to a significant extent the direction of our lives, because our values determine our lives, the coherence of our lives, because the more fully and deeply we realize our sacred values, the more our lives cohere around it. So these then are questions to explore. What is the sacred question that pulls you, and what is the sacred value? Another useful set of reflections is the brevity of this time. This is a good reflection, particularly during those difficult times. They're not going to last forever. Nothing does. If we live to 100, which isn't likely, we'll have 5,200 weeks in our lives. 1 week is very short. It'll go very quickly, but the benefits can last a lifetime. So this is a useful reminder for bringing ourselves as fully to the practice as possible. And another useful reflection, one that I particularly find helpful as a kind of inspiration, is the recognition that our practice may and our retreat may be the optimal contribution we can make to others. That we are cultivating the very qualities of heart and mind that which the world so desperately needs. Okay, so reflection. Second set of recommendations. Observe the precepts. We take here the five precepts as a minimum to avoid killing and harming, stealing, sexual activity, wrong speech, and mind-clouding intoxicants. Some of you may be taking other precepts as well, but those are kind of the basics we all agree on, which create such a wonderful, safe, harmonious environment for us all. Now, one of the things that's really valuable to know about ethics, and something which isn't really described much, is that ethics can be practiced at many levels. In fact, ethics by itself is an extraordinary practice. At the beginning level, it's simply a list of constraints. Don't kill, don't steal, don't screw around, don't say the wrong things, and don't take mind-clouding drugs. Okay, you just follow those. So that's the kind of behavioral constraint level. But there's a whole nother level of possibility for ethical practice. And this level comes out of a much deeper investigation of the mind and an appreciation of how it works. And a consequent understanding of what ethical and unethical behavior do to the mind. This inner level of ethical practice stems from a reflection of the way the mind works. And very specifically, it stems from a recognition that, and this, I recommend this as a practice or exploration, it stems from the recognition that in those moments when we are tempted to act unethically, to say or speak or act in a way which harms others, for example, if we turn attention inward at that moment, what we find is that our mind is dominated by painful, destructive motives and emotions such as greed, fear, anger, jealousy, and hatred. And here's the kicker, if we act them out, we reinforce and strengthen those painful motives and emotions. Okay? That's the bad news. There's also good news. And the good news is that when at those times we feel motivated to act ethically, to be kind and compassionate, considerate and loving, if we turn attention inward at those moments and explore, what we find is that the mind is filled and powered by positive, beneficial, spiritual, dharmic motives and emotions. Motives and emotions like love and compassion and care and kindness. And when we act those out, we can condition and strengthen them. So properly understood at this level, ethics is a mind training and a very powerful one. So you can begin to see then the recognition that there are levels of ethical training. Unfortunately, our culture only really recognizes the outer level of behavioral restraint. So the first, just to put it into three levels, a la traditional Vajrayana, outer, inner, and secret, the outer level is this behavioral restraint, avoiding inappropriate behavior. And this is obviously very helpful to oneself and to others. But if we only work on this level, then there are traps. Because it's very easy to fall into suppressing and repressing the anger, ill will, jealousy, etc., which comes up and we try to act and want to act out. We just push it out of awareness. But that isn't terribly helpful, because here are a couple of things that's really important to know about the mind. What we push out of awareness stays there. What we're unwilling to experience sticks around until you are willing to experience it. Okay? And here's where it gets really tricky. What you're unwilling to experience runs your life. Think about it. You're unwilling to experience, there's a memory that's coming to mind. We had a patient at the Stanford Medical Center when I was doing my training who had a phobia around bridges. He lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. So each day he drove 100 miles to work around the Bay Area to avoid going over a bridge and then 100 miles back. It's like what we're unwilling to experience runs our lives. That's a pretty dramatic example. But if you're unwilling to experience, for example, anger, you will push it out of awareness and then you'll notice how many angry people there are around you. Yeah. So part of our ethical work comes in subsequent stages to allowing these difficult emotions. And also, if we only act at the level of outer restraint, it feels like a sense of sacrifice at times. And we can easily feel resentful. I want this, but I can't, I can't take it. So those are the traps that go with working only at that outer level. And then there's the inner level that we've been talking about, actively, which can consist of actively working with and transforming unethical states and motives. By working with these anger, fear, greed, jealousy, hatred, etc., by investigating them, actively exploring them, or by cultivating opposing qualities. For example, cultivating love to attenuate anger. And then there's the secret level, the Dzogchen level of working with ethics. And here we simply, to whatever extent we can, rest in awareness and allow unethical motives and mind states to arise into the field of awareness. And we don't try to change them at all. We simply notice them and make a wonderful discovery that in and of themselves, they resolve, untangle, and dissolve. And this is what's called in Dzogchen self-liberation. And they self-liberate and release free energy. And so just notice what happens when anger or fear or something arises and you just allow it to be there and just let it in its own time unfold and release of itself, and you'll notice this little flash of free energy that's available. So, outer, inner, and secret ways of working with ethics. This is one map. I want to just give another map of the way ethics can unfold and deepen in multiple stages. At first, ethical practice is experienced as an effort, even a struggle, as we resist and recondition these unhealthy motives and emotions. And over time, with any habit or reconditioning, it starts to become easier and eventually becomes what in Buddhism is called effortless effort. And then at a certain stage, as we discover the benefits of ethical practice, as wisdom deepens, as insights emerge, we recognize that ethics is not just a nice way of behaving. It's not just a skillful way of working with the mind. It's actually an appropriate expression of reality and to reality. That is, when we develop pure perception, when we recognize who we are and who those around us are, then we recognize that ethical behavior is actually a totally appropriate and congruent response to reality. It's just what makes sense. Given who we really are, and given that we are surrounded by these sacred dakas and dakinis, how else would we want to respond except with kindness and care and compassion? So at this stage, ethics has moved from sacrifice to enlightened self-interest. We recognize that this is what being ethical is totally in our self-interest, as well as everyone else's interest. And at the Dzogchen level, again, it is a spontaneous, it becomes a natural, spontaneous expression of our true nature. So these are levels of working with ethics. And of course, the deeper levels encompass the earlier ones. But I hope you can see that ethical practice is an extraordinarily profound and rich practice of itself. We take it on as a commitment here. And as Buddhist practitioners, we take it on as a part of our life. But we can take it on at many levels. And this is simply to point to some of the possibilities of ethical practice and the way in which they can become an increasingly deeper expression of who we are and who everyone else is. Okay, third kind of suggestion that is repeatedly given to us for how to have optimal retreats is to do less. Very simply, in the language of Buddhism, reduce the outflows. Outflows are activities which tend to trap and distract attention and energy by drawing them outward and dissipating them. Outflows include excessive activities of any kind, speaking, writing, reading, and thinking. So first off, we maintain silence. And we do this because it's such a powerful practice. In retreat, this is our opportunity to escape the superficial busyness of society, which, as one philosopher Kierkegaard put it so nicely, tranquilizes with trivia. And we get away from our usual social busyness, which the Quran says is but diversion and distraction from spiritual life. And we practice outer silence in order to cultivate inner silence. And when silence reigns both within and without, then we can hear what can never be spoken, the wisdom that waits beyond words. Or as Black Elk, a Native American wise man, put it, is not silence the very voice of the Great Spirit? And certainly wise people the world over have thought so, and Father Thomas Keating, who was the person who reintroduced centering prayer into Christianity in our time, had a great line. He said, silence is the language God speaks, and everything else is a bad translation. And the third Zen patriarch, whose teaching is left to us in in a little piece, only a few pages, called, I think it's Verses on the Faith Mind. Got to be one of the most profound and distilled pieces of wisdom that's ever hit the planet. The first three-month retreat I ever did, I took that in and I read two lines a day. And just, I continue to read it to this day. It's like any profound text, it's bottomless. And he said, the more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there's nothing you will not be able to know. Now, we are so fortunate to have a really quiet environment here. There's a little trick to in play. When you're out, or out around sometime, or even in your hut, listen to the silence and discover something. That is, in order to hear silence, the mind has to be silent. So if you listen for silence, the mind will tend to silence by itself. Listen to the sound of the bell and follow it into silence. The mind is still. So, maintain the silence. Read less. It's tempting, and I'm always tempted, since I love reading, to read more than is skillful on retreat. But in retreat, to whatever extent you read, do it in a very different way. Not so much to acquire facts and information, but rather to read just a couple of lines to serve as a stimulus and opening. We don't have a specific name for this practice in Buddhism, but in Christianity they call it Lectio Divina, divine reading. Here's Father Thomas Keating again. We tend to read scriptures as if they were just another book to be consumed. Lectio is just the opposite. It is the savoring of the text, a leisurely lingering in divine revelation. With sacred readings, we are seeking insight rather than information. Consequently, the reading is slow and reflective, a few sentences or even words at a time. Okay, now we get to the more tricky part. Don't indulge thinking. As we all know, easier said than done. But thoughts are incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. It's interesting that two of the most powerful teachings in history, the words of the Buddha and the words from the Rig Veda, have the same message. Now, it's very interesting. If you were an awakened one and realized that your words might be echoed across centuries, what would you say? Well, it's interesting that the Dhammapada, which is one beautiful, very early text of the Buddha's, starts with a teaching on thought. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make the world. It is good to control them, and to master them brings happiness. But ah, how subtle they are, how elusive. The task is to quieten them, and by ruling them, to find happiness. Very interesting. And here's some words from the Rig Veda, the earliest Indian sacred text, the fountainhead of Hinduism. Our thoughts wander in all directions. For the sake of spirit, O mind, let go all these wandering thoughts. So, how to do this? We all have discovered that we don't have control or choice over whether any given thought will arise or not. But we do have some choice about how we respond to it once it's arisen. We can indulge it, think about it, or simply watch it. And the difference is profound. Profound. Whether we go into it or whether we simply watch it is the difference between fantasy and reality, between sleeping or awakening. For example, if a thought arises, I'm scared. Usually what happens immediately is awareness, we identify with the thought, and that becomes our belief in reality. I'm scared. And then the body starts pumping adrenaline, the mind gets agitated, we go on hyper alert, we start planning, trying to figure out what's wrong, get ourselves out of it. On the other hand, if a thought, I'm scared, arises, and we simply are aware of it, then it's just another interesting thought. It has no power, it has no compulsion over us, it does not become what we assume ourselves to be. What those thoughts we identify with become our reality. Those thoughts we witness are simply thoughts. But thoughts are very seductive. They're very tempting. They seem very important, very powerful, really, really worth thinking about. So how do we stop indulging them? Well, a couple of suggestions. One is make a resolve for this retreat not to indulge thinking. Second is to remember, there's a line from one of my teachers and some of your teachers, Joseph Goldstein, I find very helpful. Remember, nothing is worth thinking about. And another useful reminder when thoughts look entrancing, not now. By all means, at the end of the sitting, at the end of the retreat, take some notes, whatever you want. But during the sitting, during your practice, not now. And then another practice that can be useful is to include thoughts as specific objects of awareness. That is, you may, if you wish, take part of a sitting to be specifically aware of thoughts. Yeah. Usually we just, in this Dzogchen practice, we just rest in awareness. But occasionally, if you wish to do other practices, more focused practices, then by all means take a few minutes to try to recognize all the thoughts that arise. Another practice to reduce the outflows or help us with becoming less active and doing less is to slow down, to move more slowly and deliberately and consciously, to walk a little more slowly. The body and mind are intimately linked. This is the whole basis of psychosomatic medicine. And you notice we all notice when we're sitting. We get a little drowsy, a little cloudy. And if we take a moment to sit in an erect posture, it tends to clarify and alert the mind. Likewise, when you slow the body, you tend to also slow the mind. In fact, you do more than slow it. You tend to slow, settle, still, and transcend the mind. So, simply slow down to whatever extent you can. Eat slowly. One time, you know, we have time, we have the opportunity to eat as a practice. Bring as much awareness to each mouthful, each taste as possible. Another suggestion, do one thing at a time. Attention reflects activity. If we do many things, multiple things simultaneously, the mind becomes fragmented. Attention becomes fragmented. Do one thing and attention can be focused. So far we've looked then at reducing activities or outflows. That's what we've just been talking about. And we also talked about the value of reflection and of the power and potential and depth of ethics as a spiritual practice. Fourth suggestion from, and this is just one you find in every tradition, be continuous. Don't have gaps in your practice. Turn everything to the path, as we say in Buddhism. Quoting again from Joseph Goldstein, continuity is the secret of success. And the analogy he uses is of a kettle. Put a kettle on the stove and put it on the flame for a minute and then take it off and put it back, then take it off. It takes a long time to boil. Likewise with our practice. If we practice wholeheartedly for a little while and then take a break, and of course breaks are fine, but if we do it without trying to foster awareness, then it becomes a problem. Then it's a break in awareness. So we want to bring awareness to each moment of activity. And when I was practicing in Burma, a couple of the questions they used to ask us were there any times today you weren't mindful? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, now you mention it, there were. Another one was, did you fall asleep and wake up on an in-breath or an out-breath? Only once did I ever manage to answer that question. So, the direction is towards uninterrupted practice. Not struggling, not straining, just trying to bring awareness to each moment. And such uninterrupted practice is one of the highest goals of each of the great traditions. It's in Zen, it's every moment Zen. Or the Quran pleads, be constant in prayer. And both the Christian St. Paul and the Hindu sage Ramakrishna urged us to pray without ceasing. So the goal is to reach a stage at which attention and awareness are so continuous that practice ceases to be a special activity and simply becomes the context for every activity. And this is the art by which one transforms the whole act of living into spiritual practice. As part of this, we do all activities as practice, or we turn everything to the path. So we try to make all activities, walking, eating, showering, whatever, into spiritual practice. And we do this in several ways. One is by simply bringing awareness to them. And then there are the ways you notice we use in each sitting. We begin each, we do four things. There are four really useful things to do with any practice session or before any major activity. One is to stop for a moment. Sounds simple, but got to remember, just take a moment to stop. If you're about to do your service task, or if you're about to eat, or if you're about to do anything, take a moment, just stop, take a breath or two, and then do the practice. Second thing which we do before each sitting is to generate bodhicitta. We remember, revitalize our motivation for practice. Remembering that we're not practicing for ourselves alone, so we take a moment to dedicate this practice to the highest good, to the welfare and awakening of all. So first stop, second dedication, or rather intention setting or generating bodhicitta. And then we do the activity as impeccably as we can. Whatever we're doing, washing the dishes or whatever, we do it as a spiritual practice as impeccably as we can. Not again in Dzogchen as a struggle or a strain, but with a relaxed awareness. And then at the end, after any major activity, after each sitting here, what we do is we stop for a moment again and we offer the benefits. We raise the aspiration or hope or prayer or wish that what we've done can be a benefit to all, and we actually intend to give the benefits away. We offer the benefits to all beings. And again, offering, like ethics, can be done at different levels. At first, it can be just a practice of selflessness, an offering what we've given to everyone. But then, as we recognize the way the mind works at an inner level, it becomes a giving away of the benefits out of the recognition that what we intend for others, we tend to experience ourselves. If we intend for others to feel love, love is generated in our own minds. If we intend for others to feel joy, joy arises in our minds. It's one of the great secrets of practice. In fact, it's the very basis of the four immeasurables. What do we do with the four immeasurable practices? Cultivating love, empathic joy, compassion, and equanimity. We wish them for others. Not just because we're nice people, which we are obviously, but because this is a profound way of using the way the mind works. Yes, they work if you deliberately cultivate them for yourselves. May I be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. That works. But what you discover as you go deeper into these practices, they work more powerfully when you do them for everyone, yourself included. And when you're wishing well for everyone, including yourself, there are no limits or boundaries or divisions within the mind. You can't wish everyone well and have a compartmentalized mind. Okay? So again, bodhicitta, this offering the benefits, which we do after every sitting, is a practice that's profoundly based in a deep recognition of the way the mind works. And again, at the secret or Dzogchen level, there's the recognition that offering the benefits is simply a natural expression of who we really are. Our true identity is pure awareness, which is the fountainhead of all good. Pure awareness naturally, spontaneously manifests as the bliss of Sambhogakaya and the blessings of Nimanakaya. That's just what Dharmakaya or pure awareness does. And so awareness naturally rests in itself. When it meets others or meets suffering, it responds with compassion and compassionate action. When it meets others who aren't suffering, it responds with love. And when it meets others who are happy and joyful, it responds with empathic joy. These are natural, spontaneous expressions of Rigpa. So with these four steps, before, during, and after each major activity during the day, if we're going for a walk, whatever it is, stopping, remembering bodhicitta, doing our activity impeccably with awareness, and then offering the benefits, everything becomes a practice. Okay. And then if you wish, here's one activity you might just take on if you want. That is, choose a particular activity for particularly careful practice. One simple activity during the day. It might be when you wash your hands. It might be opening the door. It might be putting on or taking off your shoes. Choose one activity and decide you're going to do it as impeccably as possible. So each time you come to that activity, the mind kind of alerts and, oh, okay. And just tends to bring us present. Okay, fifth suggestion, relax. Now, effort is essential for practice, and right effort is one of the components of the Eightfold Path, and effort can be extremely intense. Let me read you an account from Hakuin, one of the great Zen masters of one of the sesshins he did, the seven-day sesshin. On one occasion, two of us engaged in a private sesshin. We pledged to continue it for 7 days and seven nights. No lying down, no sleep. We cut a 3-foot section of bamboo and fashioned it into a makeshift stick, or a shippe, that's a Zen stick for hitting, get hit with to maintain alertness. Then we sat facing each other with the shippe placed on the ground between us. We agreed if one of us saw the other's eyelids drop, even for a second, we would grab the staff and crack him with it between the eyes. We don't do that here. For 7 days, we sat ramrod straight, teeth clenched tightly in total silence. Not so much as an eyelid quivered. Right through to the end of the seventh night, neither of us had occasion to reach for that stick. That's effort. If you try it, please let me know. I'd be most interested to hear, but it's not in my realm. And fortunately, in our practice, we work with right effort, but is very much balanced with relaxation. We're into the middle way. And in Dzogchen, relaxation is really central to Dzogchen. And peace is one aspect of Rigpa awareness or pure presence. Most spiritual practices work with the mind, actively directing and moving and transforming the mind. And this eventually ends up in a calm, peaceful state of mind. But with Dzogchen, we realize the same result simply by focusing on relaxing. And more than just achieving a calm state of mind, this we aim not just to relax and create a peaceful state of mind, but to recognize the awareness which is always behind or under or permeating that mind from the start. Most spiritual practices respond to problems like agitation or greed or fear with active correction. And the type of correction varies with the problem. In our practice, we have only one response, relaxing with awareness. And to the extent we relax, those problematic mind states dissolve of themselves. Now, this isn't to say that it can't be useful to actively work with the mind in a retreat like this. And here's a general principle. If you can possibly handle a difficulty simply by relaxing with awareness, do it. If it's too much, if it's overpowering, if it's just the mind is too agitated, then by all means work with it. Go for a walk. Cultivate focused attention. Concentrate. If there's anger, release it, do some loving kindness practice. But where possible, simply come back to relaxing with awareness. Okay, sixth suggestion. Enjoy yourself. Joy is a positive mental quality. And it's okay to have a good time. In fact, it's more than okay. It's a beneficial quality of mind. And a deeper Dzogchen level, and it's a joy is recognized an expression of Rigpa. And finally, celebrate each awakening. Each time you awaken from a thought or fantasy, you have a choice. You can berate yourself for falling asleep, which will lead to anger, frustration, self-attack, guilt, and contraction. Or you can celebrate and happy that you've woken up. I recommend that. You'll fall asleep and wake up a million times. That's a lot of opportunities to be happy. And the game is to wake up one more time than you fall asleep. So, those are some of the ideas that have been passed down to us by numerous sages as ways that they've found to optimize retreats. They're wonderful suggestions and beautiful ways of practicing. As I think you'll appreciate, the more deeply we practice them, the more they become natural, easy, relaxed, peaceful, and joyous expressions of and recognitions of who we are. So, comments, questions?
Thank you for that. That was amazing. Thank you. There's something that I've talked to a lot of people about. Whenever I can, I kind of broach the subject and have never really been satisfied with. And I think I may have just gotten clarity on something, so I wanted to share it. So I kind of came to the Dharma a little different than the other sages. I realized suffering first, I think, and then that brought me here. And so my work is involving suffering a lot, like on a social justice level, dealing with poverty and injustice. And so it has been, I haven't conceptually understood why I would go to a retreat for a year, for a week, or do these things. You know, for basic health, I know I need to be healthy, so I should do yoga or eat healthy, because otherwise I can't get to my computer in the morning and send the emails that I need to send. So I can do those, but the greater purpose, it's never really sunk into me why you should trying to have a spiritual practice when that time might be better spent writing a report to the UN on blah, blah, blah that's happening. Yeah. In that moment when I make the decision, spend an hour meditating, spend an hour responding to emails so that will, you know, all the people that I help supervise, they can all be really productive themselves. In that moment, that always wins out. And I think that and I've had these conversations with everybody, and then they say, you've got to take care of yourself and all of that, and I get it. But it hasn't really sunk in, that split decision. And I think what I'm hearing now is that when you have a practice that has love, joy, equanimity, and compassion in it, when you're aware of that, and of course you've got to take the time to cultivate that. When you do that, and then you offer the benefits of the merits, then that would mean that I would be clarifying my intention so that when I write that brief to the UN, I know that the intention really is for joy, love, compassion, equanimity, for everybody to feel that I feel every single day, that I feel so much gratitude for feeling. So unless it's like that transcendence, or it's that a giving it something like that. Yeah,
beautiful. What's your name?
Nicole.
Very nice, thank you. And lest I forget, there are several people engaged in social justice issues here, and you should find each other at the end of the retreat, because it'd be wonderful to have that kind of sangha community inspiring each other. That was beautiful. Thank you very much. And you, I think, yes, exactly. There's an ocean of suffering out there. And anything we do will make a contribution, and there's always going to be more. And it's very easy to push ourselves to the point of burnout. But what we're practicing for is, for many, many reasons, for our own benefit, but also to become optimal instruments of service and healing. And to be able to serve at the deepest, able to serve and heal at the very deepest levels. Because there is an ocean of hunger and poverty and injustice and pollution and ecological degradation, and we can work to feed the hungry and institute new social justice laws, etc., which is entirely appropriate. But what we recognize from our Dharma practice is that those what we call the great problems of the world are actually symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective mental, psychological, spiritual dysfunctions. And if the deepest kind of contribution we can offer, it is one which heals the very roots of those sufferings, which fundamentally are within the mind, the greed, hatred, delusion, or the three or five poisons. Those are the roots from which these branches or symptoms stem. And to the extent we only deal with the symptoms, then new problems will just keep arising. So one thing we're looking for is to be able to serve in the most strategic ways, the most profound ways, the deepest ways. And that requires that we recognize in each interaction, in each problem, the deeper, the deep roots, which are their cause, and the depth of the depth we can, how deeply we can see into the problems and their roots is a function of how deeply we have touched into ourselves. So that our depth, our inner depth, becomes the limiting or facilitating factor for how deeply and profoundly we can work in the world. And eventually we bring those together. We go into ourselves to go more effectively out into the world, and we use our activity in the world as part of our spiritual experience, so a spiritual practice, so we work in the world to go more deeply into ourselves. And in one way, it's like continuing our education. You know, all of us could have quit, dropped out of high school and tried to heal the suffering of the world. But probably everyone in this room is more effective for having gotten a good education. Well, some of us have got a lot of education, and some people like me never left the educational system, never got out or graduated. But this is kind of like postdoctoral work. I mean, to me, it feels like this is the most profound or graduate level of work we can do, and allows us to contribute in the most effective, strategic, and profound ways we can. So yeah, thanks, Nicole. Thank you. Please.
I just, could you address, I got the great problems of the world are actually symptoms. Could you take it, I'm clueless, symptoms of our personal, symptoms of what?
Symptoms of our individual, well, you can put it several ways, symptoms of our individual and collective psychological and spiritual immaturity. Symptoms of our individual and collective dysfunction. You know, our technological power has become so great that we're kind of like the sorcerer's apprentice. We now have such power, individually and collectively as a species, that we essentially make the world in our own image. The world we see is an expression of our individual and collective desires and fears and phobias and neuroses and delusions. And to the extent we recognize that, to that extent, we are called to this kind of deeper work. Thank you.
Hi, Roger. This is more related to post retreat, but I work with a lot of patients, as do you, and one of the things I can work well with depression patients and identify a lot of those things, but so many people in this world, it seems like, have anxiety, like tremendous anxiety, with panic attacks daily, weekly, etc., and I mean, it's not too dissimilar, obviously, in our own selves. But just, did you have any ideas, since you work with these patients so often yourself, that any principles that apply, particular practices, perhaps, or?
Feels like a big topic, and one that maybe would be best a conversation between us. And also, Christopher is very appropriately pointing to his watch, so. Giving a subtle and utterly appropriate reminder that time has passed, actually, not just. So let's dedicate offer the benefits, and let's see here. What have we got? What do we do? Uh, How about, gee, 22, 23, is that's what I'm looking for. I love it that you, right. As Christopher, as I was saying, pages 22, 23, dedication of virtue. By this virtue may we swiftly realize and fully embody the natural great perfection, and thereby bring all without exception to its complete realization. May the pure, brilliant sun of bodhicitta dawn in each and every heart and mind, dispelling the darkness of suffering and confusion, unstoppably until all are illumined and awakened.